school friend. Someone she would hug with genuine, teary tenderness if they met at their school reunion, and then not see again until the next reunion. Jane got down on her knees and looked under the couch. "Ruth asked about Ziggy," said her mother meaningfully.
"Did she?"
said Jane. "I showed her the photo of Ziggy on his first day of school, and I was watching her face, and she didn't say anything, thank goodness, but I just knew what she was thinking, because I have to say, Ziggy's smile in that photo does look a teeny bit like, 'Mum, Ziggy looks nothing like Zach,'" said Jane, getting back to her feet. She hated it when she caught herself deconstructing Ziggy's beautiful face, looking for a familiar feature. The lips, the nose, the eyes. Sometimes she thought she'd see something, a flash of something out of the corner of her eye, and then she'd die a little before quickly reassembling Ziggy into Ziggy.
"Oh, I know," said her mother. "Nothing at all like Zach."
"And Zach is not Ziggy's father."
"Oh, I know that, darling. Goodness, I know that. You would have told me."
"More to the point, I would have told Zach." Zach had phoned her after Ziggy was born.
"Is there something you need to tell me, Jane?"
he'd said in a tight, bright voice.
"Nope,"
Jane had told him, and she'd heard his tiny exhalation of relief.
"Well, I know that," said her mother.
She quickly changed the subject. "Tell me, did you get some good photos with the class toy? Your father is emailing you this wonderful place where you can get them printed off for...
How much is it, Bill? How much?
No, Jane's photos, for that thing she has to do for Ziggy."
"Mum,"
interrupted Jane. She walked into the kitchen and picked up Ziggy's backpack, where it lay on the floor. She picked it up and held it upside down. Nothing fell out.
"It's fine, Mum. I know where to get the photos done."
Her mother ignored her.
"Bill, listen to me. You said there was a website."
Her voice faded. Jane walked into Ziggy's bedroom, where he was sitting on the floor playing with his Lego. She lifted up his bedclothes and shook them.
"He's going to email you the details," said her mother.
"Wonderful," said Jane distractedly. "I've got to go, Mum. I'll call you tomorrow." She hung up. Her heart pounded. She pressed the palm of her hand to her forehead. No, surely not. She could not have been so stupid. Ziggy looked up at her curiously. Jane said, "I think we've got a problem." There was silence when Madeline picked up the phone.
"Hello,"
said Madeline again.
"Who is it?"
She could hear someone crying and saying something incoherent.
"Jane?"
Madeline suddenly recognized the voice.
"What's the matter? What is it?"
"It's nothing," said Jane. She sniffed. "Nobody died. Well, it's sort of funny, really. Oh, it's hilarious that I'm crying over this."
"What happened?"
"It's just... oh, what will those other mothers think of me now?" Jane's voice quavered.
"Who cares what they think?" said Madeline.
"I care," said Jane.
"Jane, just tell me, what is it? What happened?"
"We've lost him," sobbed Jane.
"Lost who? You've lost Ziggy."
Madeline felt the panic rise. She was obsessed with losing her own children and quickly confirmed their respective locations. Chloe in bed, Fred doing his reading with Ed, Abigail staying at her dad's place. Yet again.
"We left him sitting on the seat. I remember actually thinking what a disaster it would be if we left him behind. I actually thought that, but then Josh got his bleeding nose and we all got distracted. I've left a message on the lost property number, but he wasn't labelled or anything.
Jane, you're not making any sense.
Harry the hippo. We've lost Harry the hippo.
Thea. Well, that's the thing about these Gen Y kids. They're careless. Harry the hippo had been with the school for over 10 years. That cheap synthetic toy she replaced it with smelled just terrible. Made in China. The hippo's face wasn't even friendly. Harper. Look, it wasn't so much that she lost Harry the hippo, but that she put photos in the scrapbook of the exclusive little group who went to Disney on Ice. So all the kids get to see that. And the poor little tots are thinking, why wasn't I invited? As I said to Renata, that was just thoughtless. Samantha. Yes, and you know what's really shocking? Those were the last photos ever taken of Harry the hippo. Harry the heritage-listed hippo. Harry the... Sorry. It's not funny. It's not funny at all. Gabrielle. Oh, my God. The fuss when poor Jane lost the class toy and everyone is pretending it's not a big deal. But clearly it is a big deal. And I'm thinking, can you people get a life? Hey, do I look thinner than when we last met? I've lost 3 kilos. Chapter 24. 3 months before the trivia night. Go green, cried Madeline as she sprayed green hairspray into Chloe's hair for the athletics carnival. Chloe and Fred were dolphins and their house colour was green, which was fortunate because Madeline looked good in green. When Abigail had been at her old primary school, her house colour was unflattering yellow. That stuff is so bad for the ozone layer, said Abigail. Really? Madeline held the spray can aloft. Didn't we fix that? Mum, you can't fix the hole in the ozone layer. Abigail rolled her eyes with contempt as she ate her homemade, preservative-free flaxseed and whatever the hell else was in it, muesli. These days, whenever she came home from her father's place, she got out of his car weighed down with food, as if she'd been provisioned for a trip to the wilderness. I didn't mean we fixed the whole ozone layer. I meant the thing with aerosol cans. Something or others. Madeline held up the hairspray can and frowned at it, trying to read the writing on the side, but the type was too small. Madeline had once had a boyfriend who thought she was cute and stupid. And it was true, she was cute and stupid the whole time she was with him. Living with a teenage daughter was exactly the same. The CFCs, said Ed. Aerosol cans don't have CFCs anymore. Whatever, said Abigail. The twins think their mum is going to win the mother's race today, said Chloe, as Madeline began to French braid her green hair. But I told them you were a trillion times faster. Madeline laughed. She couldn't imagine Celeste running in a race. She'd probably run in the wrong direction, or not even notice the starter gun had gone off. She was always so distracted. Bonnie will probably win, said Abigail. She's a really fast runner. Bonnie, said Madeline. Warned Ed. What? Snapped Abigail. Why shouldn't she be fast? I just thought she was more into yoga and things like that. Non-cardio things, said Madeline. She returned to Chloe's hair. She's fast. I've seen her in a race with Dad at the beach, and Bonnie is like
much younger than you, Mum. Ed chuckled. You're a brave girl, Abigail. Madeline laughed.
One day, Abigail, when you're 30, I'm going to repeat back to you some of the things you've said to me over the past year.
Abigail threw down her spoon.
I'm just saying, don't get upset if you don't win.
Yes, yes, okay. Thank you, said Madeline soothingly. She and Ed had laughed at Abigail when she hadn't meant to be funny, and she didn't quite understand why it was funny, so she now felt embarrassed and therefore enraged.
I mean, I don't know why you feel so competitive with her, said Abigail viciously. It's not like you want to be married to Dad anymore, do you? So what's your problem?
Abigail, said Ed, I don't like your tone. Speak nicely to your mother.
Madeline shook her head slightly at Ed.
God!
Abigail pushed away her breakfast bowl and stood up.
Oh, calamity, thought Madeline. There goes the morning.
Chloe swiveled her head away from Madeline's hands so she could watch her sister.
I can't even speak now.
Abigail's whole body trembled.
I can't even be myself in my own home. I can't relax.
Madeline was reminded of Abigail's first ever tantrum when she was nearly 3. Madeline had thought that she was never going to have a tantrum, all due to her good parenting. So it had been such a shock to see Abigail's little body whipped about by violent emotion. She'd wanted to keep eating a chocolate frog she'd dropped on the supermarket floor. Madeline should just have let the poor kid eat it.
Abigail, there's no need to be so dramatic. Just calm down, said Ed.
Madeline thought, thank you, darling, because that always works, doesn't it? Telling a woman to calm down.
Mom! I can only find one shoe, hollered Fred from down the hallway. Just a minute, Fred, called back Madeline.
Abigail shook her head slowly, as if truly flabbergasted by the outrageous treatment she was forced to endure.
You know what, Mum? She said without looking at Madeline. I was going to tell you this later, but I'll tell you now. Mum! Yelled Fred. Mummy is busy, screeched Chloe. Look under your bed, shouted Ed.
Madeline's ears rang. What is it, Abigail?
I've decided I want to live full time with Dad and Bonnie.
What did you say? Said Madeline. But she'd heard. She'd feared it for so long, and everyone kept saying, no, no, that would never happen. Abigail would never do that. She needs her mother. But Madeline had known for months it was coming. She knew it would happen. She wanted to scream at Ed. Why did you tell her to calm down?
I just feel it's better for me, said Abigail. Spiritually.
She'd stopped trembling now and calmly took her bowl from the table over to the sink. Lately, she'd begun walking the same way Bonnie walked. Back, ballet dancer straight, eyes on some spiritual point on the horizon.
Chloe's face crumpled. I don't want Abigail to live with her dad.
Tears spilled copiously. The colour on the green lightning shapes on her cheeks began to run.
Mum!
Shouted Fred. The neighbours would think he was being murdered. Ed dropped his forehead into his hand.
If that's what you really want, said Madeline.
Abigail turned from the sink and met her eyes, and for a moment it was just the two of them, like it was for all those years. Madeline and Abigail, the Mackenzie girls. When life was quiet and simple. They used to eat breakfast in bed together before school, side by side, pillows behind their backs, their books on their laps. Madeline held her gaze. Remember, Abigail?
Remember us?
Abigail turned away. That's what I want.
Stu.
I was there at the athletics carnival. The mother's race was fucking hilarious. Oh, excuse my French. But some of those women, you'd think it was the Olympics. Seriously.
Samantha.
Oh, rubbish. Ignore my husband. Nobody was taking it seriously. I was laughing so hard, I got a stitch.
Nathan was at the carnival. Madeline couldn't believe it when she ran into him outside the sausage sizzle stall, hand in hand with Skye. This morning, of all mornings. Not many dads came to the athletics carnival, unless they were stay-at-home dads or their children were especially sporty. But here was Madeline's ex-husband taking the time off work to be there, wearing a striped polo shirt and shorts, baseball cap and sunglasses. The quintessential good daddy uniform.
So, this is a first for you, said Madeline.
She saw there was a whistle around his neck. He was volunteering, for God's sake. He was being involved. Ed was the sort of dad who volunteered at the school, but he was on deadline today. Nathan was pretending to be Ed. He was pretending to be a good man, and everyone was falling for it.
Sure is, beamed Nathan.
And then his smile vanished as presumably it crossed his mind that his firstborn daughter must have taken part in athletics carnivals when she was in primary school too. Of course, these days he was at all of Abigail's events. Abigail wasn't sporty, but she played the violin, and Nathan and Bonnie were at every concert without fail, beaming and clapping, as if they'd been there all along, as if they'd driven her to those violin lessons in Petersham where you could never get a parking spot, as if they'd helped pay for all those lessons that Madeline couldn't afford as a single mother with an ex-husband who didn't contribute a single cent. And now she was choosing him.
Has Abigail spoken to you about...
Nathan winced a little, as if he were referring to a delicate health issue.
About living with you, said Madeline. She has. Just this morning, actually.
The hurt felt physical, like the start of a bad flu. Like betrayal. He looked at her.
Is that...
fine with me? Said Madeline. She would not give him the satisfaction.
We'll have to work out the money, said Nathan.
He paid child support for Abigail now that he was a good person. Paid it on time, without complaint, and neither of them ever referred to the first 10 years of Abigail's life, when apparently it hadn't cost anything to feed or clothe her.
So you mean I'll have to pay you child support now? Said Madeline.
Nathan looked shocked.
No, I didn't mean that.
But you're right. It's only fair if she's living at your place most of the time, said Madeline.
Obviously, I would never take your money, Maddie, he interrupted. When all those years...
He grimaced.
Look, I'm aware that I wasn't the best father when Abigail was little. I should never have mentioned money. Things are just a bit tight for us at the moment.
Maybe you should sell your flash sports car, said Madeline.
Yeah, said Nathan.
He looked mortified.
I should. You're right. Although it's not actually worth as much as you... anyway.
Skye gazed up at her father with big worried eyes, and she did that rapid blinking thing again that Abigail used to do. Madeline saw Nathan smile fiercely at the little girl and squeeze her hand. She'd shamed him. She'd shamed him while he stood hand in hand with his waif-like daughter. Ex-husbands should live in different suburbs. They should send their children to different schools. There should be legislation to prevent this. You are not meant to deal with complicated feelings of betrayal and hurt and guilt at your kid's athletics carnival. Feelings like this should not be brought out in public. Why did you have to move here, Nathan? She sighed.
What? Said Nathan.
Madeline, time for the kindy mums race. You up for it? It was the kindergarten teacher, Miss Barnes, hair up in a high ponytail, skin glowing like an American cheerleader. She looked fresh and fecund, a delicious ripe piece of fruit, even riper than Bonnie. Her eyelids didn't sag, nothing sagged. Everything in her bright young life was clear and simple and perky. Nathan took his sunglasses off to see her better, visibly cheered just by the sight of her. Ed would have been the same.
Bring it on, Miss Barnes, said Madeline.
Detective Sergeant Adrian Quinlan.
We're looking at the victim's relationships with every parent who attended the trivia night.
Harper. Yes, as a matter of fact, I do have certain theories.
Stew. Theories? I've got nothing. Nothing but a hangover.
Chapter 25. The kindergarten mothers gathered in a ragged, giggly line at the start line of their race. The sunlight reflected off their sunglasses. The sky was a giant blue shell. The sea glinted sapphire on the horizon. Jane smiled at the other mothers. The other mothers smiled back at her. It was all very nice, very sociable.
I'm sure it's all in your head, Jane's mother had told her. Everyone will have forgotten that silly mix-up on orientation day.
Jane had been trying so hard to fit into the school community. She did canteen duty every 2 weeks. Every Monday morning, she and another parent volunteer helped out Miss Barnes by listening to the children practice their reading. She made polite chit-chat at drop-off and pick-up. She invited children over for playdates. But still Jane felt that something was not right. It was there in the slight turn of a head, the smiles that didn't reach eyes, the gentle waft of judgment. This was not a big deal, she kept telling herself. This was little stuff. There was no need for the sense of dread. This world of lunch boxes and library bags, grazed knees and grubby little faces, was in no way connected to the ugliness of that warm spring night and the bright downlight like a staring eye in the ceiling, the pressure on her throat, the whispered words worming their way into her brain. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Now Jane waved at Ziggy, who was sitting on the bleachers near the sidelines with the kindergarten kids under the watchful eye of Miss Barnes. You know I'm not going to win, right? She'd said to him this morning at breakfast. Some of these mothers had personal trainers. One of them was a personal trainer.
On your marks, mums, said Jonathan, the nice stay-at-home dad who had gone with them to Disney on Ice.
How many metres is this anyway? Said Harper.
The finish line looks like it's a long way away, said Gabrielle. Let's all go have coffee instead.
Is that Renata and Celeste holding the finishing tape? Said Samantha. How did they get out of this?
I think Renata said that she...
Renata has shin splints, interrupted Harper. Very painful, apparently.
We should all stretch, girls, said Bonnie,
who was dressed like she was about to teach a yoga class,
a yellow singlet top sliding off one shoulder as she languidly lifted one ankle and pulled it up behind her leg.
"Oh, by the way, Jess," said Audrey or Andrea. Jane could never remember her name. She stepped right up close to Jane and spoke in a low, confidential voice, as if she were about to reveal a deep, dark secret. Jane had gotten used to it by now. The other day she stepped up close, lowered her voice, and said, "Is it library day today?"
"It's Jane," said Jane. Well, she could hardly be offended.
"Oh, sorry," said Andrea or Audrey. "Listen, are you for or against?"
"For or against what?" said Jane.
"Ladies!" cried Jonathan.
"Cupcakes," said Audrey or Andrea. "For or against?"
"She's for," said Madeline. "Fun police."
"Madeline, let her speak for herself," said Audrey or Andrea. "She looks very health conscious to me."
Madeline rolled her eyes. "Well, I like cupcakes," said Jane.
"We're doing a petition to ban parents from sending in cupcakes for the whole class on their kids' birthdays," said Andrea or Audrey. "There's an obesity crisis, and every second day the children are having sugary treats."
"What I don't get is why this school is so obsessed with petitions," said Madeline irritably. "It's so adversarial. Why can't you just make a suggestion? Ladies, please."
Jonathan held up his starter gun.
"Where's Jackie today, Jonathan?" asked Gabrielle.
The mothers were all mildly obsessed with Jonathan's wife, ever since she'd been interviewed on the business segment of the evening news a few nights back, sounding terrifyingly precise and clever about a corporate takeover and putting the journalist in his place. Also, Jonathan was very good-looking in a George Clooney-esque way, so constant references to his wife were necessary to show that they hadn't noticed this and weren't flirting with him.
"She's in Melbourne," said Jonathan. "Stop talking to me. On your marks."
The women moved to the start line.
"Bonnie looks so professional," commented Samantha, as Bonnie crouched down into a starting position.
"I hardly ever run these days," said Bonnie. "It's so violent on the joints."
Jane saw Madeline glance over at Bonnie and dig the toe of her sneaker firmly into the grass.
"Enough with the chit-chat, ladies," roared Jonathan. "I love it when you're masterful, Jonathan," said Samantha. "Get set."
"This is quite nerve-wracking," said Audrey or Andrea to Jane. "How do the poor kids cope with the..."
The gun cracked.
Thea.
"I do have my own ideas about what might have happened, but I'd rather not speak ill of the dead. As I say to my four daughters, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all."
Chapter 26. Celeste could feel the pressure of Renata's grip at the other end of the finishing tape, and she tried to match it with her own, except that she kept forgetting to concentrate on where she was and what she was doing.
"How's Perry?" called out Renata. "In the country at the moment?"
Whenever Renata made an appearance at school or school events, she made an amusing point of not talking to Jane or Madeline. Madeline loved it. Poor Jane, not so much. But she always talked to Celeste, in a defensive, prickly way, as though Celeste were an old friend who had wronged her, but she was choosing to be mature and rise above it.
"He's great," called back Celeste.
Last night, it had been over Lego. The boys had left their Lego everywhere. She should have made them pick it up. Perry was right. It was just easier to do it herself after they were asleep, rather than do battle with them. The whining, the drama.
She just didn't have the resilience last night to go through with it. Lazy parenting. She was a bad mother.
You're turning them into spoiled brats, Perry had said.
They're only five, Celeste had said. She was sitting on the couch folding laundry. They get tired after school.
I don't want to live in a pigsty, said Perry.
He kicked at the Lego on the floor. So pick it up yourself, said Celeste tiredly. There. Right there. She brought it on herself. Every time. Perry just looked at her. Then he got down on his hands and knees and carefully picked up every piece of Lego from the carpet and put it in the big green box. She'd kept folding, watching him. Was he really going to just pick it all up? He stood and carried the box over to where she sat.
It's pretty simple. Either get the kids to pick it up, or pick it up yourself, or pay for a fucking housekeeper.
In one swift move, he upended the entire box of Lego over her head in a noisy, violent torrent. The shock and humiliation made her gasp. She stood up, grabbed a handful of Lego from her lap, and threw it straight at his face. See there? Again, Celeste at fault. She behaved like a child. It was almost laughable. Slapstick. The two grown-ups throwing things at each other. He slapped her across the face with the back of his hand. He never punched her. He would never do anything so uncouth. She staggered back, and her knee banged against the edge of the glass coffee table. She regained her balance and flew at him with her hands like claws. He shoved her away from him with disgust. Well, why not? Her behavior was disgusting. He went to bed then, and she cleaned up all the Lego and threw their uneaten dinner in the bin. Her lip was bruised and tender this morning, like she was about to get a cold sore. It wasn't enough for anyone to comment upon. Her knee had banged against the side of the coffee table, and it was stiff and painful. Not too bad. Not much at all, really. This morning Perry had been cheerful, whistling while he boiled eggs for the boys.
What happened to your neck, Daddy? Said Josh.
There was a long, thin red scratch down the side of his neck, where Celeste must have scratched him.
My neck?
Perry had put his hand over the scratch and glanced over at Celeste with laughter in his eyes. It was the sort of humorous, secret look that parents share when their children say something innocent and cute about Santa Claus or sex. As if what happened last night were a normal part of married life.
It's nothing, mate, he'd said to Josh. I wasn't looking where I was going, and I walked into a tree.
Celeste couldn't get the expression on Perry's face out of her mind. He thought it was funny. He genuinely thought it was funny, and of no particular consequence. Celeste pressed a finger to her tender lip. Was it normal? Perry would say, no, we're not normal. We're not Mr. and Mrs. Average, mediocre people in mediocre relationships. We're different. We're special. We love each other more. Everything is more intense for us. We have better sex. The starter gun cracked the air, startling her.
Here they come, said Renata.
14 women ran straight at them as if they were chasing thieves, arms pumping, chests thrust forward, chins jutting, some of them laughing, but most looking deadly serious. The children shouted and hollered. Celeste tried to look for the boys, but she couldn't see them. I can't run in the mother's race after all, she'd told them this morning. I fell down the stairs after he went to bed last night.
Oh, said Max.
but it was an automatic whine. He didn't seem to really care.
You should be more careful,
Josh had said quietly, without looking at her. I should, Celeste had agreed. She really should. Bonnie and Madeline led the pack. They pulled in front. It was neck and neck. Go, Madeline, thought Celeste. Go, go, go. Yes! Their chests hit the finishing tape. Definitely Madeline. Bonnie by a nose, shouted Renata.
No, no, I'm sure Madeline was first, said Bonnie to Renata. Bonnie didn't seem to have exerted herself at all. The colour on her cheeks was just a little higher than usual.
No, no, it was you, Bonnie, said Madeline breathlessly, although she knew she'd won. Madeline had Bonnie in her peripheral vision the whole time. She bent over, hands on her knees, trying to catch her breath. There was a stinging sensation on her cheekbone where her necklace had whipped across it.
I'm pretty sure it was Madeline, said Celeste.
Definitely Bonnie, interrupted Renata. And Madeline nearly laughed out loud. So your vendetta has come to this now, Renata. Not letting me win the mother's race?
I'm sure it was Madeline, said Bonnie.
I'm sure it was Bonnie, countered Madeline. Oh, for heaven's sake, let's call it a tie, said a year six mother, a blonde bob in charge of handing out the ribbons. Madeline straightened. Absolutely not. Bonnie is the winner. She plucked the blue winner's ribbon from the year six mother's hand and pressed it into Bonnie's palm, folding her fingers over it, as if she were entrusting one of the children with a $2 coin.
You beat me, Bonnie. She met Bonnie's pale blue eyes and saw understanding register. You beat me fair and square.
Samantha. Madeline won. We were all killing ourselves laughing when Renata insisted it was Bonnie. But do I think that led to a murder? No, I do not.
Harper, I came in third, if anyone is interested.
Melissa, technically, Juliet came third. You know, Renata's nanny. But Harper was all, a 21-year-old nanny doesn't count. And then, of course, these days, we all like to pretend Juliet never existed.
Chapter 27. Samantha.
Listen, you need to get your head around the demographics of this place. So, first of all, you've got your blue collars. Tradies, we call them. We've got a lot of tradies in Pirui. Like my stew. Salt of the earth. Or salt of the sea, because they all surf, of course. Most of the tradies grew up here and never left. Then, you've got your alternative types. Your dippy hippies. And in the last 10 years or so, all these wealthy execs and banker wankers have moved in and built massive McMansions up on the cliffs. But there's only one primary school for all our kids. So at school events, you've got a plumber, a banker, and a crystal healer standing around trying to make conversation. It's hilarious. No wonder we had a riot.
Celeste arrived home from the athletics carnival to find her house cleaner's car parked out front. When she turned the key in the front door, the vacuum cleaner was roaring upstairs. She went into the kitchen to make herself a cup of tea. The cleaners came once a week on a Friday morning. They charged $200 and did a beautiful, sparkling job. Celeste's mother had gasped when she'd heard how much Celeste spent on cleaning.
Darling, I'll come and help you once a week, she'd said. You can save the money for something else.
Her mother could not grasp the scale of Perry's wealth. When she first visited the big house with the sweeping beach views, she'd walked around with the polite, strained expression of a tourist watching a confronting cultural demonstration. she'd finally agreed it was very airy. For her, $200 was a scandalous amount of money to spend on something that you could, should, do yourself. She would be horrified if she could see Celeste right now, sitting down, while other people cleaned her house. Celeste's mother had never sat down. She came home from working night shift at the hospital, walked straight into the kitchen and made the family a cooked breakfast, while Celeste's dad read the paper, and Celeste and her brother fought. Good God, the fights Celeste had had with her brother. He'd hit her. She'd always hit him back. Maybe if she hadn't grown up with a big brother, if she hadn't grown up with that tough Aussie tomboy mentality, if a boy hits you, you hit him right back. Perhaps if she'd wept softly and prettily the first time that Perry hit her, then maybe it wouldn't keep happening. The vacuum cleaner stopped, and she heard a man's voice, followed by a roar of raucous laughter. Her cleaners were a young, married Korean couple. They normally worked in complete silence when Celeste was in the house, so they mustn't have heard her come in. They only showed her their professional faces. She felt irrationally hurt, as if she wanted to be their friend. "Let's all laugh and chat while you clean my house." There were running footsteps above her head and a peal of girlish laughter. "Stop having fun in my house. Clean." Celeste drank her tea. The mug stung her sore lip. She felt jealous of her cleaners. Here she sat in her big house, sulking. She put down her tea, took her Amex card out of her wallet, and opened her laptop. She logged onto the World Vision website and clicked through photos of children available for sponsorship. Products on a shelf for rich white women like her. She already sponsored three children, and she tried to get the boys interested. "Look, here's little Blessing from Zimbabwe. She has to walk miles for fresh water. You just have to walk to the tap."
"Why doesn't she just get some money from the ATM?" said Josh.
It was Perry who answered, who patiently explained, who talked to the children about gratitude and helping those less fortunate than themselves. Celeste sponsored another four children. Writing letters and birthday cards to them all would take hours. Ungrateful bitch. Deserve to be hit. Deserve it. She pinched the flesh on her upper thighs until it brought tears to her eyes. There would be new bruises tomorrow. Bruises she'd given herself. She liked to watch them change, deepening, darkening, and then slowly fading. It was a hobby, an interest of hers. Nice to have an interest. She was losing her mind. She trawled through charity websites, representing all the pain and suffering the world has to offer. Cancer, rare genetic disorders, poverty, human rights abuse, natural disasters. She gave and gave and gave. Within 20 minutes, she'd donated $20,000 of Perry's money. It gave her no satisfaction, no pride or pleasure. It sickened her. She made charitable donations while a young girl got down on her hands and knees and scrubbed the grubby corners of her shower stall. "Clean your own house, then. Sack the cleaners." But that wouldn't help them either, would it? "Give more money to charity. Give until it hurts." She spent another $5,000. Would that hurt their financial situation? She didn't actually know. Perry took care of the money. It was his area of expertise, after all. He didn't hide it from her.
She knew that he would happily go through all their accounts and investment portfolios with her if she so wished, but the thought of knowing the exact figures gave her vertigo.
"I opened the electricity bill today and I just wanted to cry," Madeline had said the other day. And Celeste had wanted to offer to pay for it for her. But of course, Madeline didn't want her charity. She and Ed were perfectly comfortable. It was just that there were so many different levels of comfortable. And at Celeste's level, no electricity bill could make her cry. Anyway, you couldn't just hand money over to your friends. You could pick up lunch or coffee whenever you could, but even then you had to be careful not to offend, not to do it so often that it looked like you were showing off, as if the money were part of her, when, in fact, the money was Perry's. It had nothing to do with her. It was just random luck, like the way she looked. It wasn't a decision she'd made. Once, when she'd been at uni, she'd been in a great mood, and she'd bounced into her tutorial and sat next to a girl called Linda. "Morning," she'd said. An expression of comical dismay crossed Linda's face. "Oh, Celeste," she'd moaned, "I just can't handle you today. Not when I'm feeling like shit, and you waltz in here looking like, you know, like that." She waved her hand at Celeste's face, as if at something disgusting. The girls around them had exploded with joyous laughter, as if something hilarious and subversive had finally been said out loud. They laughed and laughed, and Celeste had smiled stiffly, idiotically, because how could you possibly respond to that? It felt like a slap, but she had to respond like it was a compliment. You had to be grateful. "Don't ever look too happy," she told herself. "It's aggravating." Grateful, grateful, grateful. The vacuum cleaner stopped upstairs. Perry had never, in all their years together, made a comment on how she chose to spend their, his, money, except to remind her occasionally, mildly, humorously, that she could spend more if she liked. "You know we can afford to get you a new one," he'd said once, when he came upon her in the laundry, scrubbing furiously at a stain on the collar of a silk shirt. "I like this one," she'd said. The stain was blood. Once she stopped working, her relationship to money had changed. She used it in the same way she'd use someone else's bathroom, carefully and politely. She knew that in the eyes of the law and society, supposedly she was contributing to their lives by running the house and bringing up the boys. But she still never spent Perry's money in the same way she'd once spent her own. She'd certainly never spent $25,000 in one afternoon. Would he comment? Would he be angry? Was that why she'd done it? Sometimes on the days when she could feel his rage simmering, when she knew it was only a matter of time, when she could smell it in the air, she'd deliberately provoke him. She'd make it happen. So it was done. Even when she was giving to charity, was it really just another step in the sick dance of their marriage? It wasn't like it was unprecedented. They went to charity balls, and Perry would bid $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 with the unsmiling nod of a head. But that wasn't about giving, so much as winning. "I'll never be outbid," he told her once. He was generous with his money. If he ever discovered that a family member or friend was in need, he discreetly wrote a check or did a direct transfer, waving away thanks, changing the subject, seemingly embarrassed by the ease with which he could solve someone else's financial crisis. The doorbell rang, and she went to answer it. "Mrs. White?" A stocky, bearded man handed her a giant bouquet of flowers.
"Thank you," said Celeste.
"Someone is a lucky lady," said the man,
as if he'd never seen a woman receive such an impressive arrangement.
"I sure am."
The sweet, heavy scent tickled her nose. Once, she'd loved to receive flowers. Now it was like being handed a series of tasks. Find the vase, cut the stems, arrange them like so. Ungrateful bitch. She read the tiny card. "I love you. I'm sorry. Perry." Written in the florist's handwriting. It was always so strange to see Perry's words transcribed by someone else. Did the florist wonder what Perry had done? What husbandly transgression had he committed last night? Coming home late? She carried the flowers toward the kitchen. The bouquet was shaking, she noticed, shivering as if it were cold. She tightened her grip on the stems. She could throw them against the wall, but it would be so unsatisfying. They would flop ineffectually to the ground. There would be drifts of sodden petals across the carpet. She'd have to scrabble around on the floor for them before the cleaners came downstairs. "For God's sake, Celeste, you know what you have to do." She remembered the year she turned 25. The year she appeared in court for the first time. The year she bought her first car and invested in the stock market for the first time. The year she played competitive squash every Saturday. She had great triceps and a loud laugh. That was the year she met Perry. Motherhood and marriage had made her a soft, spongy version of the girl she used to be. She laid the flowers down carefully on the dining room table and went back to her laptop. She typed the words, "marriage counselor," into Google. Then she stopped. Backspace, backspace, backspace. No. Been there, done that. This wasn't about housework and hurt feelings. She needed to talk to someone who knew that people behaved like this. Someone who would ask the right questions. She could feel her cheeks burn as she typed in the two shameful words. Domestic violence. Chapter 28. "There are harder things than this," thought Madeline, as she folded a pair of white skinny jeans and added them to the half-packed open suitcase on Abigail's bed. Madeline had no right to the feelings she was experiencing. Their magnitude embarrassed her. They were wildly disproportionate to the situation at hand. So Abigail wanted to live with her father, and she wasn't being all that nice about it. But she was 14. 14-year-olds were not known for their empathy. Madeline kept thinking she was fine about it. She was over it. No big deal. She was busy. Other things to do. And then it would hit her again, like a blow to the abdomen. She'd find herself taking short, shallow breaths, as if she were in labor. 27 hours with Abigail. Nathan and the midwife joked about football while Madeline died. Well, she didn't die, but she remembered thinking that this sort of pain could only end in death, and the last words she'd hear would be about Manly's chances of winning the premiership. She lifted one of Abigail's tops from the laundry basket. It was a pale, peachy colour, and it didn't suit Abigail's colouring, but she loved it. It was hand wash only. Bonnie could do that now. Or maybe the new upgraded version of Nathan did laundry now. Nathan version 2.0. Stays with his wife. Volunteers at homeless shelters. Hand washes.
He was coming over later today with his brother's truck to pick up Abigail's bed. Last night, Abigail had asked Madeline if she could please take her bed to Nathan's house. It was a beautiful four-poster canopy bed that Madeline and Ed had given Abigail for her 14th birthday. It had been worth every exorbitant cent to see the ecstasy on Abigail's face when she first saw it. She'd actually danced with joy. It was like remembering another person.
"Your bed stays here," Ed said.
"It's her bed," Madeline had said. "I don't mind if she takes it." She said it to hurt Abigail, to hurt her back, to show that she didn't care that Abigail was moving out, that she would now come to visit on weekends. But her real life, her real home, would be somewhere else. But Abigail wasn't hurt at all. She was just pleased she was getting the bed.
"Hey," said Ed from the bedroom door.
"Hey," said Madeline.
"Abigail should be packing her own clothes," said Ed. "Surely she's old enough."
Maybe she was, but Madeline did all her laundry in the house. She knew where things were in the wash, dry, fold, put away assembly line, so it made sense for Madeline to do it. Ever since Ed had first met Abigail, he'd always expected just a little too much of her. How many times had she heard those exact words? "Surely she's old enough." He didn't know children of Abigail's age, and it seemed to Madeline that he always shot just a little too high. It was different with Fred and Chloe, because he'd been there from the beginning. He knew and understood them in a way he never really knew and understood Abigail. Of course he was fond of her, and he was a good, attentive stepdad, stepping immediately into the role without complaint. 2 months after they began dating, Ed went with Abigail to a Father's Day morning tea at school. Abigail had adored him back then. And maybe they would have had a great relationship, except that Nathan, the prodigal father, had returned at the worst time, when Abigail was 11. Too old to be managed, too young to understand or control her feelings. She changed overnight. It was as though she thought showing Ed even just basic courtesy was a betrayal of her father. Ed had an old-fashioned authoritarian streak that didn't respond well to disrespect, and it certainly compared unfavorably to Nathan's "let's have a laugh" persona.
"Do you think it's my fault?" said Ed.
Madeline looked up.
"What?"
"That Abigail is moving in with her dad." He looked distressed, uncertain. "Was I too hard on her?"
"Of course not," she said. Although she did think it was partly his fault. But what was the point in saying that?
"I think Bonnie is the real attraction," she said.
"Do you ever wonder if Bonnie has had electric shock treatment?" mused Ed.
"There's definitely something missing," said Madeline. Ed came in and ran his hand over one of the posts of Abigail's bed.
"I had a hell of a job putting this together," he said. "Do you think Nathan will be able to manage it?"
Madeline snorted.
"Maybe I should offer to help," said Ed.
He was serious. He couldn't bear to think of a DIY job being done badly.
"Don't you dare," said Madeline. "Shouldn't you be gone? Don't you have an interview?"
"Yeah, I do." Ed bent to kiss her.
"Someone interesting?"
"It's Piriwee Peninsula's oldest book club," said Ed. "They've been meeting once a month for 40 years.
"I should start a book club," said Madeline.
Harper. I will say this for Madeline. She invited all the parents to join her book club, including Renata and me. I already belong to a book club, so I declined, which is probably just as well. Renata and I always enjoyed quality literature, not those lightweight, derivative bestsellers. Pure fluff. Each to their own, of course. Samantha. The whole erotic book club started as a joke. It was actually my fault. I was doing canteen duty.